Good evening, Lehigh Valley. This is Sally Hanlon. I am your host this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. And this evening we're doing a topic that, for those that you listen to the show all the time, we have Healthcare Part 3 that we're talking about with Richard Master and Vince Mundella. And I think you're going to want to stay glued to your radio or to your computer as you listen to what these gentlemen have to say. Our topic, or what we're talking about tonight, is myths debunked and the single-payer system. So single-payer health insurance is offered and accepted throughout the world, and it gets a black eye by our U.S. lobbyists and commercial insurance companies. Similar to other pay-to-play areas within our government, this has a greater impact on all U.S. citizens, not just special interest groups. So think about that. This is something that affects all of us, whether or not we're working, whether or not we're families. It's everybody is affected by this system of health care that we have, or disease care. There is a growing momentum now with physicians, educators, business owners, and elected government leaders, spawned by the efforts of these two local business leaders, as I said, Richard Master of MCS Industry and Vincent Mundella of Mundella Productions. Richard and Vince have been on this crusade since 2014, so 5 years, and they have created a foundation, a charitable foundation called Unfinished Business Foundation, and a website with very eye-opening videos, and that website is fixithealthcare.com. They also have a national effort called the Business Initiative, and we'll talk a little bit about all of these things. We only have an hour of your time, so listen closely, because I'm sure we're going to get a lot of information out to you. So, first of all, welcome, Richard. Glad to have you back.
It's great to be back here with you, Sally.
Yeah, this is such an amazing journey of the two of you. And Vince, thank you for joining us again and being a part of this.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting us.
Sure. The most recent documentary that these two gentlemen have done is another eye-opener. So I want to tell you all, go to fixithealthcare.com. I want to talk a little bit about Richard and his background if you're just listening to this show for the first time and haven't caught on the other two shows that we've done. Richard is, his father founded MCS Industries, and he officially changed the name of the family business to MCS Industries from Easton Box Company. It was founded in 1948 by his father, who was a manufacturer of rigid paper boxes and apparel industry in Eastern PA. So since his purchase in 1980, MCS has become a leading supplier of wall and poster frames and also a top supplier of tabletop frames, photo albums, scrapbooks. He is, as I said, the founder of the Business Initiative for Health Policy. Richard, share with our audience a little bit, our listening audience, how this MCS Industries matches what you're doing now is at your vocation, avocation with healthcare.
Well, I'm the CEO and chairman of the board of MCS Industries, and thank you for referring to that, and also to my father, you know, who passed away in the 1970s. And I had been a lawyer in Washington, D.C.
I was
a trial lawyer with the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department,
okay. And
then involved in politically in some campaigns and also in law practice. And as my father deteriorated, I came back to the Lehigh Valley to help his operations. I had been a student at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, so I had, you know, a foundation in the business world. And that actually helped me, that foundation in economics and business management helped me to transition our business into a more successful and larger consumer products world, and it's been a great ride for me and also for my associates at MCS. We're now the leading manufacturer of picture frames and also decorative mirrors in the United States, in North America.
So if I go to Bed Bath & Beyond, chances are I'll see your product?
Chances are that you'll see our products at all the major mass market retailers.
Okay. And now I understand the connection between your advocacy for healthcare because of your background as an attorney and what you did in Washington.
Yeah, it's very interesting that most of the supporters of single payer Medicare for all are human rights advocates. They consider this a basic human right. And we take a different stance. We are now looking at this as a prudent step for our economy, that our economy essentially is being eaten alive by its healthcare system. And this reform is really essential to bring runaway healthcare cost under control.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Interesting. And Vince, your background with Lou Rita Productions led you to your own production company, and you've been very busy with other productions like the History Channel, Biography Channel, A&E. Wow. And how did you get on the healthcare bandwagon here, the crusade?
Well, Richard and I have known each other for years, but, you know, a few times had discussed doing projects, but never really ended up working together. And then he called me about wanting to do a little film about drug prices.
Right.
And one thing led to another, and before you know it, we were crisscrossing the country and up in Canada and, you know, expanded the concept into, you know, dealing with, you know, with the overall healthcare system. Okay. And, you know, after the deep dive in our research, we both became, you know, rather obsessed with this issue.
Yeah, well, and thank goodness you both are, you know, and you're keeping it in the forefront.
Yeah, it hasn't been for our personal psychology. It's been really a challenge because, you know, every time you turn over one of these rocks and see this outrageous set of circumstances, it's depressing.
Yeah,
we should not have to tolerate this in you know, as citizens in this country. We're, you know, the leading economy in the world, and we can't provide healthcare for one third of our proper healthcare for one third of our citizens. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and the fact that we also strap businesses, especially small businesses, with the, you know, role of providing that healthcare, that's not fair either.
No, so it certainly isn't.
We're going to get into that, listeners, but I would like Richard and Vince to talk a little bit about the documentaries that they've done that have led up to this most recent single-payer direction that they're going on. In 2016, that's when the first documentary, Fix It Healthcare, came out, Healthcare at the Tipping Point. And then there were two more made, which was Big Pharma Market Failure and Big Money Agenda, and then Democracy on the Brink. So could we just sort of recap a little bit about what each of these is? Because I really would like our listeners to understand sort of a 50,000-mile view so that they can go onto the website and really get a chance to listen and view these.
Sure. Well, you know, Fix It Healthcare at the Tipping Point really focuses on the insurance industry, which we think is the major obstacle to reform, that commercial insurance is really an unnecessary middleman in the healthcare supply chain, but a very expensive one. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's costing 20% of premiums, $1.3 trillion annually now in health insurance premiums for 155 million people, and including families that have employer-based insurance, essentially. Employer-based insurance.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you to repeat that again because we're going to be talking about the impact of single payer. So the number again was
155 million Americans receive some form of commercial coverage through commercial insurance companies.
And the cost of
$1.3 trillion annually in an economy that's close to $20 trillion. It's a huge percent of our economy going into insurance for health. If you look overall at the healthcare system, it's around $3.6 trillion now, 18% of the economy. In other countries, that it's you know, less than 10%. Right. We're now 18, 19%. We're going to go be at 20% in the mid-220s. Yeah.
Wow.
So
crazy.
It's a really serious problem because the healthcare system is really running away from us. And that's the first movie was Fix It, Healthcare at the Tipping Point.
Okay.
We felt that at that point in 2016 and reflecting on 2014 numbers that we had reached the point of no more, no mas, please.
Yeah.
The tolerance of the society had reached its limit, but it continues to grow. You know, certainly we're over $10,000 per capita for healthcare in the United States. And, you know, many families don't make that much.
Right.
And at my company, you know, a policy for a family is $28,000 a year. The average worker works productively about 2,000 hours. So it's $14 an hour for healthcare for that worker. That one worker.
So anybody with minimum wage or even under $15 an hour is really not making anything.
That's right. And so this affects employers and employees because employees, you know, in most companies pay a proportion of that insurance plan.
Yeah.
They pay upwards of 20-25%, which is typical. So that was the first movie. The second movie is looks at the pharmaceutical industry and its big pharma market failure, and it shows how the free market system just has not been effective in regulating price in the United States through systems of intellectual property, patent protection. We've created all these monopolies. Specialty drugs give the right of a pharmaceutical manufacturer to charge essentially whatever they want, whatever they think the market can bear. And in most countries, there is a regulatory arm that establishes reasonable pricing for critical drugs. It's aggravated, really, in the United States because the American taxpayer is so much involved in financing the research and development.
That was something that I really found fascinating in that documentary.
35 trillion, bill, excuse me, I'm getting my
trillion.
Billions and trillions mixed up here, but $35 billion a year going through the National Institute of Health, National Institute of Science, et cetera, going to basic research, which then, under law, can be commercialized by manufacturers. And that has then led to Wall Street getting involved in bidding up the prices of these discoveries. And so a drug that may cost $250 to produce will end up costing $80,000 to administer.
To the end user.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think one of the important issues here, because now that pharma is feeling the pressure, we're seeing all of these pretty commercials about life-changing research.
Yeah.
When in fact, one particular study, highly respected peer-reviewed journal, found that pharma spends maybe 2% on that kind of research, 2% of their gross, and that the vast majority of their so-called research money is going just to develop drugs to compete with drugs that are already out there and already on the market and not this kind of new breakthrough situation. And virtually,
that is interesting.
And virtually every congressional hearing that looks into drug prices has found that the relationship between the so-called R&D and pricing, there's no connection at all. They're essentially trying to make as much money as possible on the drug. The research is not a factor in that.
Interesting. Well, and you know, it's interesting that maybe that we don't, as the Drug Administration, put a cap on what, if it's commercialized, what people can charge for the fact that the research has already been done.
Yes, yes. You know, and there are provisions in the law that allow for the director of the National Institute of Health, where he sees that there is an exploitive situation, to come in and say, essentially, you are using federally financed research to manufacture these, and you should be selling them at reasonable prices.
Right.
It has never been used.
Well, it has been, but it's lost in court every time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we have the law as a potentiality, but every time it ends up in a courtroom, never wins. So, you know, it's essentially it's toothless.
Okay. The other thing that I thought was very interesting in this particular documentary that you did was understanding that the VA and Medicare VA has some negotiating capabilities with the drug mm-hmm. companies, but Medicare doesn't have any negotiating capabilities.
By law, the Medicare must accept the list price for pharmaceuticals. They cannot establish a national formulary, and they cannot negotiate price. That was part of the Medicare Part D law, which is absurd. And, you know, there are efforts in Congress to change that. And certainly the Medicare for All legislation that's now in play in Congress. We have provisions that relate to pharmaceutical drug price negotiation and price regulation.
But on the other hand, when these drug companies in the U.S. sell abroad, they are regulated by those countries.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Correct. So they regulate. If you want to sell your drugs, for example, in Canada, you have to go through a price review board. And that also regulates the annual increase, the inflationary increase, to a certain level. We have none of that.
Yeah.
They can increase prices 10% a year with no rationalization, no justification.
And Canada does a very simple thing as part of that process. Their fundamental rule is we can't be charged much more than the world average.
Okay.
So it's not even.
And they dropped the U.S. from that average.
Well, of course.
And that's why you see a lot of folks going up to Canada.
And the fact that other countries are able to do it and we don't do it, we're in essence subsidizing these pharmaceutical companies because we're paying the high price tags.
Well, and the pharmaceutical companies who don't really need a lot of subsidization, you know, they're making well over $100 billion a year in profit. It's the gross margins on pharmaceuticals are a dream. It's a dream world in the business community.
Wow.
It's just
wow.
crazy.
Listeners, we've just begun, and we're going to be taking a short break. You're going to want to stay glued to your radio or to your computer right now. My guests tonight are Richard Master, who's chairman and CEO of MCS Industries, and Vince Mondello, who is producer, director, writer at Mondello Productions. This is Sally Hanlon for Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Welcome back. If you just tuned in, this is Sally Hanlon, and you are listening to 88.1 WDIY's Lehigh Valley Discourse with our guests this evening, Richard Master, Chairman and CEO of MCS Industries, and Vince Mondello, producer, director, writer, Mondello Productions. We are discussing our healthcare, single-payer system, pharmaceutical congress. You get the idea. So we're talking about things that these gentlemen have done, documented, researched. It's incredible. And before the break, we were talking about the documentaries that they've done in the past. We have one more before we get on to debunking, and that is Democracy on the Brink. So let's give our listeners a little summary of what that documentary is about.
Well, The last major documentary, The Big Money Agenda, Democracy on the Brink, really talks about why we're in the pickle that we're in.
Okay.
You know, where we look at all this extraordinary cost and really the crisis that we are in healthcare, and it's not working for businesses and folks that work in those businesses, but it certainly is working for the healthcare sector. You know, they're making extraordinary profits, and how do they do that? Well, they use a lot of that profitability to influence national healthcare policy through the U.S. Congress. And if you see an initiative, a reform initiative, you're going to see popping up front groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce would be a front group that is carrying the torch for the industry. So they're spending $300 million a year on lobbying.
Wow.
They've spent over the last decade over $3 billion lobbying Congress. They're the largest lobbying sector in American industry. They're major campaign contributors. Whenever there's a plebiscite or a referendum on drug price reform, they will throw in $120 million, and the community will try to raise money, and they may come up with $10 million. So they're really blowing opposition out of the water. So that we called it the big money agenda.
Yeah, it is.
And fortunately, we had Wendell Potter, who, when he worked in the industry, was one of the architects of the insurance company and pharmaceutical company agenda, and then had enough. He reached his personal tipping point and an emotional crisis, and about 10 years ago decided that he had to do something
to correct
some of these behaviors.
I think one thing to keep in mind, though, regarding Richard's point about the chamber, he's referring to the U.S., the national chamber, mm-hmm. and they often are dealing in money for big, big corporations and big sectors of the economy, and it's often in counterpoint to local chambers and small business interests.
Right.
So we don't want to create the impression that the chamber is this evil empire. It's really that the big money side of the national chamber as opposed to local chambers, which are operating in a very different scenario.
With sort of healthcare being something that they want to achieve at a reasonable cost.
Yes, yeah. And thanks for correcting me. You know, if you look at the national chamber's budget, they may have hundreds of thousands of members, but essentially 40, 50 members account for about, and these are the largest corporations in the United States, account for over 60% of the money coming in to support those organizations. And at some point, if one of those organizations, one of the businesses is under siege, the chamber will, national chamber will mobilize in support. And that's really what happened under when the Affordable Care Act was being, contemplated in the 2008, 2009. Tens of millions of dollars went through the chamber to support, a status quo and no change.
And you know, it's so hard when you're talking about that volume of money. I mean, all the good that could be done with those funds for a lot of reasons, not just healthcare, but other things that suffer in this country, and to have it focused on that and really not be beneficial to the majority of the constituents.
Essentially, it's not fair.
No, it's correct.
Right.
It's not fair. Well, let's move on to what we really wanted to talk about was myths debunked in the single payer system, which is what you two have been doing the last year or so. It's focused on that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. When we first started Fix It, I mean, one of the first things we had to do was determine how we are going to gather facts, mm-hmm. gather information, gather data, because there's so much propaganda out there. So when we started our process of making these films, we were very rigorous about all of our data coming from peer-reviewed, third-party, semi-objective sources, not, you know, right or left-wing think tanks. Mm-hmm. So with that process, we became very sensitive to how much stuff there is out there that really is not based on anything except anecdotal or theoretical
perceptions
or out-and-out lies, as Wendell, mm-hmm. you know, clearly indicated when he was part of the industry. So we had to sort through a lot of that in our own process. And now we put out our films, and once again, what we're facing is all of these myths about healthcare that are just fundamentally, we'll call them out and out lies. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just take, for example, the big myth of choice. If we get rid of private insurance, we're going to lose choice. Well, what does that mean? If the Medicare for All proposal has no deductibles and it's for everybody and there's no limited networks and on and on and on, how could you be talking about limited choice?
Right.
And yet, if you look at private insurance, you could be dealing with a policy that's a $7,000 deductible, $1,200 a month premium. And yet the myth is out there, and you're going to see it over the next several months and over the next year, that it's going to eliminate choice or it's going to ration care, when in fact one-third of Americans can't get care now within our system.
Right.
That's rationing. Nowhere in the world rations healthcare the way we do.
Well, it's, you can get it if you've got the money to pay
yeah.
for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, we should clarify that as well. That, you know, we have about 30 million people in the United States who don't have any coverage at all. And that's growing.
After Obamacare.
It's after Obamacare. And that group is growing. We were at 32. We're now down to 29 million and change. And then you really got to look at the underinsured. These are folks with policies but have high deductibles. And what we know from economic data is that working families don't have $1,000 to pay to start at the beginning of a year to start accessing care, because they have to pay the first $5,000 or $3,000, depending on what the deductible is. And so they don't go to the doctor.
Right.
25% of people do not fill prescriptions that they need from mm-hmm. their doctors.
They can't afford it. Mm-hmm.
They just can't afford it. So, we think that the number of folks who are responding negatively to the economic barriers to care is somewhere around one-third of the population.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge number. And that also explains really the relatively poor outcomes in general. The longevity in the United States. France is 3 years, 4 years more than us. Switzerland, 5 years. Canada, 2.5, 3 years of increased longevity. People just are not accessing care. And mm-hmm. Sally, well, there's an interesting anomaly here. When people get to Medicare age, the access to care goes up dramatically, mm-hmm. and we see the differential in health outcomes in the United States begin to level off and be equal to those other countries.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is really financially determined.
Yeah.
Well, before the show...
Can I make one other comment there?
Mm-hmm.
Just to talk about the weight of what Richard's bringing up here. Under Obamacare, the current allowable deductible is a little over $7,000 for an individual. So you're facing $7,000 before one penny of insurance is paid. If it's a family plan, mm-hmm. it's
$12,000.
Okay. So family plan, you got to put out $12,000 from your own pocket if you have one of those policies. before you collect one penny in insurance.
And what were you saying about seniors before the show?
And seniors is a separate issue that they're allowed to charge triple the premium rate for a senior versus somebody who's younger. So this makes seniors very difficult in terms of, you know, having insurance, particularly as they edge up towards Medicare. So you get a lot of seniors who are sick, who need treatment, who are holding off until they get Medicare.
Yeah, it's incredible. And Richard, you were also saying before we started the show about the bankruptcies that are related to healthcare costs.
Yes. That number, you know, there are about 1 million bankruptcies a year, personal bankruptcies. 600,000 of them are medically related, medical expense related. About 1.4 million people live in those families. And most of those families have some form of coverage, but it's just insufficient.
Yeah, it's hard to come up with, you know, in a stress situation anyhow, you know, to come up with that money when you're not working or, you know.
Yeah, I think the number of Americans that have more than 1,000 in the bank is, I think, way less than 50%.
You know, and Sally, we're talking about a situation that can be corrected.
Fixed, yeah.
It can be fixed, and there is legislation, and there are, you know, there's dramatic support for that legislation in the House. We have the Jayapal bill, and there are over 100 congressmen that are co-sponsoring that bill. So this is going to come to a head in 2020, and we're preparing for that.
Let's hope that everybody gets on the bandwagon and supports you on this, because I can't think of anything that would make a difference to everybody as much as this would. You know, it's going to affect all layers of our society here.
And it's interesting that, you know, the one thing that the Obama administration did accomplish is that it expanded Medicaid, which provided 15, 18 million additional low-income folks with health care, inexpensive health care. But it's the middle class now that is really under siege.
Under suffering from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're not really getting the level of subsidies, and they're really struggling with health care.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had mentioned Wendell and his effort, both of you, as far as trying to sort of undo or write, you know, some of the information that was out there. Some of the things, you mentioned freedom of choice being one of the myths that, you know, you still will have freedom of choice. The other myth that you hear a lot when you hear about Canada, and the other one, is that the quality of care is poor. Let's address that myth.
I'll take that one.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite myths.
Okay.
Quality of care. In interviewing Professor Rodwin at NYU, who is one of the major healthcare policy experts in the country, often testifies in Congress, he said that one of the most effective ways of truly creating a level comparison point between countries is if you look at the curing of preventable diseases. Mm-hmm, in other words, if you get something that can be cured by medicine, then we determine once you've been diagnosed, how do you end up? The U.S. ends up 19 out of 19 on that fundamental, highly regarded measure of quality comparisons.
Wow.
Then you look at the World Health Organization that does an analysis comparing systems, and the U.S. comes out number 37, down there with third world countries. So this idea that other countries have poor care is just a ludicrous myth. Canada in particular, for example, they have done what are called meta studies, which means you look at all the studies that have been done and determine what the conclusion is. And there's never been a meta study done that indicates that the U.S. is vastly superior in quality to Canada. This idea that Canadians are crossing the border to get great care in the U.S., they actually did a study of that and surveyed 120,000 Canadians. They found out of the 120,000, 80 of them had gotten care in the U.S., And of the 80, 60 of them were on vacation and had emergency situations.
Probably in Florida getting away from the cold.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it.
So only 20 out of the 120,000 actually came to the U.S. specifically for care. And that could mean anything. That could mean it's a rich person that's going to Sloan Kettering or, yeah, you know, yeah, some of our best institutions.
Certainly we do have some of the great world prominent centers of excellence in the United States care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have some, and
for sure.
and we should acknowledge that mm-hmm. that the problem is access. Can folks of reasonable means get the care that they need? And they can't in the United States to a lesser and lesser extent.
Well, and this goes along with another one I think that we often hear is people are dying in wait lines for healthcare procedures mm-hmm. in countries outside of the U.S. because
yes.
of the national healthcare.
Total
plans.
And utter myth. Okay, we went to Canada, and I'll admit I had never been there and wasn't exposed to the system. I expected to go to Canada and go into a hospital and see peeling walls, gurneys lined up with half-dead bodies. That's not what's happening at all. The vast majority of wait times in Canada are specifically for elective procedures, meaning procedures that aren't going to impact your health by waiting and certainly not going to die.
Right.
So, and we talked to a number of Canadian doctors, and most of them have never even had waiting as an issue, period. Secondly, if you go to British Columbia, you can go to a website where you can actually pick a part of the body. They'll show you every single doctor available that works in a particular procedure, and you'll see their wait times. So if you're concerned most about a wait time, you can pick a doctor who's got a short wait list. Or you can go to your doctor if you're having a struggle and get the doctor to try to get you to the head of the line, you know,
yeah,
if it's something.
Of, yeah.
But if you get a heart attack, cancer, any major illness, you're going to get treated in Canada as quickly.
Or maybe more quickly.
Well, if it's a dermatologist, way more quickly.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Listeners, we've got to take a break again, and I really wish I could have these gentlemen with us all night. Yeah, we're only getting through a few of the topics. But we're going to take a short break, and as you've heard, my guests tonight are Richard Master, Chairman and CEO of MCS Industries, and Vince Mondello, who is producer, director, writer of Mondello Productions. This is Sally Hanlon for Lehigh Valley Discourse.
For program support on WDIY, we thank The Lodge, providing a housing and recovery program for adults with mental illness and supported employment at Cafe The Lodge, 427 East 4th Street, Bethlehem. Cafe The Lodge, a nonprofit bistro serving breakfast, lunch, and special event catering. For more information and a full list of special events and public programs, cafethelodge.org.
Welcome back. If you've just tuned in, this is Sally Hanlon, and you are listening to 88.1 WDIY's Lehigh Valley Discourse with our guests this evening, Richard Master, Chairman and CEO of MCS Industries, and Vince Mondello, producer, director, writer of Mondello Productions. And we're talking about healthcare, and the topic for tonight, and we're getting to it now, but it's debunking myths, debunked single payer. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about this effort, because as Richard mentioned in our last segment, you know, 2020 is the year that this hopefully will start to tip in the direction of supporting the constituents of the U.S. So let's talk about, you know, what's going on and how are you doing this and all, you know, where do we, if somebody's listening here and wants to plug in and say, yes, I agree, I want to get involved, how do we do that?
Well, thanks for that introduction, because how do we reform the system? You know, we got into this situation because we certainly saw the crisis that we were in, and I'm a person who, you know, is a fixer. That's what I do in my business life. You know, folks come to us with their problems and their circumstances in our business world, and we've gotta reform and change and adapt. And so that's the issue here. How are we going to move forward? Well, if you're a doctor, and we see more and more physicians being absorbed into these massive health networks, being dissatisfied by being, you know, they used to have this remarkable stature in our community. The head of the hospital was a doctor who was the most revered person in the community, mm-hmm. and now a number of the leaders are business people, are commercially oriented folks that are leading the. So doctors have become sort of like this cog in the middle of a health network that they should be leading.
Right.
So they can join a group called the Physicians for a National Healthcare Plan, very active nationally, providing a lot of the basic research and some political activism as well. There are 25,000 of these doctors who are meeting and involved. We have one of the immediate past president on our board. If you're a business person, you can reach out and join our business group called the Business Initiative for Health Policy. And we have now over 1,000 businesses across the country that are affiliated with business initiatives at the state level and with our organization. We have a board of business leaders that are, we're building a very interesting board. The head of the CEO of Cape Air is on our board. The head of Sweetheart Cup, CEO of Sweetheart Cup, and a major corrugated manufacturer around the country, the largest private one, is on our board. Ben and Jerry, you know, from Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream are members of our board. A major investor out of California who did Blue Apron is Joe Sandberg. He's on our board. So we have major people. And even on our local level, we have A&H Sportswear who's mm-hmm. on our board. We've had discussions with Easton Coach with 750 employees is on our board. We're involved. We've had discussions with many of the business folks. Some of them, you know, business people are generally reluctant to speak out about national policy. They don't think it's appropriate for them to do it. But we have a major sympathetic folks who are getting involved. They're taking their heads out of the sand and starting to voice opinions. The average citizen, we've got to get ready for 2020. You know, there's going to be, in both conventions, there's going to be a platform committee. We need delegates. We need delegates to run for office, you know, in the 2020 elections and get to those national conventions and be on the platform committees and advocate for a national healthcare plan and for pharmaceutical price regulation, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're, you know, labor unions are now getting involved. We're seeing a mobilization leading to 2020. And ultimately, we're hopeful that the stars will line up, that we get a progressive president, that we get a progressive Senate. We already have a progressive House of Representatives, and we think we can accomplish this in 2021.
We also have Lehigh Valley Medicare for All, which is a grassroots organization that has screened Fix-It probably over 60 times with Q&As and then recruiting people in those audiences to either our mailing list or as many as 40 of them signed up for training to be able to facilitate screenings with Q&As. So
terrific.
A lot of local enthusiasm for what's going on. And they played a factor, I think, in our local congressional election as well.
Let's make sure that we all understand that what the terms are, because you hear it Medicare for All, you hear universal health care, this is all one and the same, single payer. They're all the same, correct?
Yes, pretty much they're all the same. You know, there are halfway solutions, public option. There's some advocates for buy-in for Medicare. But that doesn't really accomplish the objective. We need to take certain elements of the healthcare supply chain out of the equation because they really take so much cost. We can focus on a couple of them. Pharmacy benefit managers. They have no real value. Insurance companies. They take 20% of premiums on the financing side. And then on the provider side, they cause about 25% of revenue in cost. Compared to in Canada, it's about 12% of revenue. In the United States, it's over $600-$700 that every citizen pays for provider-level administration. In Canada, it's less than $200. So we're talking about huge sums, huge drains that result from a very complicated healthcare system that we can simplify the way other countries have.
Let's talk about that a little bit because you, in some of your presentations, I picked up some facts here, and I'd like our listeners to be aware of this. You talked about the difference in the administration costs of commercial insurance and hospitals versus like a single-payer Medicare.
Yes.
But Medicare, and this just floored me, Medicare employs 6,100 people to administer the program. Commercial insurance, 470,000 salaries are coming out of that.
Right. That's why Medicare is at approximately 2 to 5% overhead of their total amount of spend, mm-hmm. and the rest of it all goes to actually pay providers. Insurance, it's 15 to 20% overhead. So right off the bat, there's that huge gap. There's this idea that anything run by the government is inefficient.
Right, right.
In Medicare, it's totally the opposite of that particular myth.
Right. Well, and I can tell you, and I think I've mentioned this before when we've spoken in the past, I was like dreading Medicare when I reached the age that I could finally get it. And I think it's because of the age number that goes with it. But I have been so impressed with just the way the system works, how quickly I get my information. It's incredible.
Yes, it's relatively simple.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, we're creating a pot from which reimbursements to providers of care are made. Now, insurance companies, consider every payment to a provider of care as a loss. So they're scrutinizing and sometimes over-scrutinizing and fighting back and forth and creating all this dialogue because they would prefer not to pay.
Well,
and I don't blame them. They're in business to for the benefit of their shareholders, but it just doesn't work. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
It's just not necessary, particularly when you're going to cover everyone, when everyone is in this risk pool. You really don't need all of this algorithms and calculations. I sit down every year negotiating with these folks, and they come in and they say, look, it's going to be 20% that's going to us for paying for agents and for paying and all these calculations. And frankly, even with my education, I can't figure out all these calculations. It becomes,
it's
have
like figuring out your hospital bill.
Get up and bang my head against the wall a few times just to get. So it's really a major challenge. It doesn't have to be that way.
No, it doesn't. And there is, the second guessing, I think, of the doctor also drives me crazy.
That is a terrible, terrible situation that people are unaware of. They talk about government takeover. We don't have government controlling my health care. Right now, insurance companies do.
That's absolutely true.
Doctors spend an average of 4 hours a week interacting with insurance companies, whether it's for a pre-approval or they got to do a battle to challenge a denial. This is what the system has become.
And they're nurses. And they're nurses who do nothing. And you'll see in our movies nurses complaining that, they spend so much of their time and get so aggravated in negotiating and advising of insurance mid-level folks who then, refer things upstairs and downstairs and all
different answers all the time.
That does not happen
to?
That does not happen in Medicare.
No, it doesn't.
They don't get that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're well serviced.
So this is, again, to get back to your theme of myths, mm-hmm. the idea that private insurance is somehow superior and non-intrusive and not, you know, telling a doctor what to do. They're micromanaging medicine all the time, challenging the prescription, challenging the potential test, procedures, goes on every single day. And every time I meet a doctor or nurse, I always ask them about this.
Yeah.
And Sally, these are the folks, the insurance companies, we give them this money.
Yeah.
And to represent us and to negotiate best prices with providers of care, with hospitals. Well, they don't have the power that Medicare has. And as a result, they pay twice as much. So they're doing and this will become a challenge because the system has gotten out of skew, out of whack, that we're too dependent on insurance company revenues to subsidize some Medicare revenues, creating an excess of revenue going into hospitals, massive amounts of liquid reserves in hospitals that really are not so necessary. And we have them here in the Lehigh Valley as well. If you look at the 990 returns, tax returns mm-hmm. of the major hospital networks here, you'll see massive amounts of reserves.
Yeah, and one other point regarding this concern with Medicare overhead. When the Advantage plans started, which are run by private insurance, they were given a 12% overhead to, quote, get them started, mm-hmm. get the ball rolling. It was supposed to drop then down to 5% overhead. And, of course, it never did. And every time the Congress tries to get back in there, the insurance companies are screaming, they're trying to cut your Medicare. No, they're trying to cut the overhead that was supposed to drop to 5%. Now, again, that 12% overhead for Advantage plans compared to 2% overhead of regular Medicare. So it's literally 5 times as much overhead.
Right. The last short video that we did was with Gerald Friedman, who is the principal architect of state plans, state Medicare for All plans, and also a major health analyst, economist for the country, mm-hmm. Out of the University of Massachusetts, Harvard-trained economist. And we asked Jerry to do a tax plan.
To pay for the...
What is this going to cost?
Mm-hmm.
So right now at MCS, at my company, it costs 22% of payroll for healthcare. And I've talked to other businesses. It's upwards of 40% for some of these businesses, mm-hmm. or 30%. Some of our municipalities and school systems, it's very, very high. We can do this for less than 10%. And frankly, less than 10% is higher than Canada is presently costing, and France, which is the number one system rated in the world, is costing. So, but it would be such a benefit to the business community and to employees who, if we go from 22% and down to 10%, that frees up so much more disposable wage compensation for wage increases and other things.
That's incredible. Wow. So one of the things that I think you had mentioned in one of the single-payer Lehigh Valley groups things was that the initial cost to do all of the Medicare for All was really not that high. I mean, you talk about bringing it down to 10%, but overall, if we were to do that and not have all these other things, I mean, it's like pennies.
Yeah, the cost to insure the uninsured is significantly less than we're paying now in waste.
Right.
Because one-third of our total spend is waste that does not go to actual health care.
Yeah, I mean, it is substantial. And also, we're anticipating that there will be an increase in utilization, because as these bills really eliminate the economic barriers, all economic barriers. So we're going to eliminate copays. We're going to eliminate deductibles. You go present a card and you get coverage. You go to the pharmacy, you get medications. I mean, we certainly won't include cosmetic,
right?
And those kinds of elective procedures, but fundamentally, this will be such a benefit for everyone. It will relieve so much anxiety that families have.
Well, now. And the other thing, based on the comment you made earlier, is hopefully it'll begin to reduce the level of chronic illness, because people will be seeking help and getting help at an earlier time,
yes,
in their illness progression.
Right. And yeah, and that will also ultimately bring costs down.
Absolutely.
An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure,
absolutely,
as we know.
You know, I was at a conference over the weekend, and there was a comment made there that it's a very basic comment, but it was about health care. And they said, you know, we'll be doing much better when we care more about health than profits. And I think I'd like to have everybody who is in the healthcare take a Hippocratic oath that says that you've got to look at your patient, got to look at the individual before you look at what you're making within that transaction.
Yes.
It's crazy. Listeners, I'm sorry, we've got to close. We're out of time, and we're just going to have Richard and Vince back again, and hopefully early on in 2020, because, you know, let's keep the momentum going. But we've just had a great time. So thank you both for being a part of this. Richard Master, Chairman of and CEO of MCS Industries, and Vince, Producer, Director, Writer of Mondello Productions. Thank you both for taking the time to be here and talk about this with our listeners. And listeners, thank you for supporting WDIY and listening this evening. This is Sally Hanlon for Lehigh Valley Discourse.